serious problem.
It is.
Yeah.
Dude, my understanding is the snack bar won't be open.
Won't be open?
Well, Mary Childs is out, so.
It's not on the, agenda.
Not on the menu either, huh?
But not here.
Oh, no.
I do actually wanna roll that into, and this is what a teacher does, right? I mean, the teacher takes something that comes from here and kind of brings it in. And so there's this image we have. I mean, John Wayne was in at least three, if not four or five, of those films, the top 10 grossing films of that year. And John Wayne, I mean, is one of the iconic figures of America. And we have this image of John Wayne. And what you're doing is, again, what we were doing yesterday, is taking, there is this surface idea of 1962, this last year post-war innocence, is the way Taylor Branch put it, right? And then beneath the surface, I read that passage from Parting the Waters about what was actually going on in the Kennedy White House with, you know, sexual relationships and connections to the mafia. I mean, it was all sorts of stuff that was very toxic, clearly incredibly toxic. And of course, we're at the beginning of the development of the Vietnam War. So that's there as well. And so, you know, partly what intrigues me about this novel and about this question of 50 years ago and the founding of Holton is, you know, we have this idea, we have this image of America. And it's a powerful and very beautiful image, but there's also this underbelly. And one of the key terms that keeps coming up in the novel, and as I keep thinking about it, is the notion of power. Where does power lie? Where do we find power? Where do we get it? Where does our power lie? And I've simultaneously been doing a lot of reading in the work of Gary Snyder. How many of you are familiar with who Gary Snyder is, just to start there? Sort of. Okay. Nobody else. I mentioned Gary Snyder yesterday. First came to fame 1950, associated with the Beat Poets. He was one of the readers when Allen Ginsberg read in at City Lights in San Francisco in 1955, read his poem Howl. Jack Kerouac was there. Ginsberg, Snyder were among the readers that day. What Gary Snyder did, Gary Snyder, like Ken Kesey, from the Northwest, originally born and raised outside of the city of Seattle, went to Reed College in Oregon, so very much associated with that, and then went down to San Francisco and got very interested in Asian religions, very interested in Zen in particular. And Snyder, rather than doing a kind of surface version of that, the way many people did in the 1950s and early 60s, Snyder went to Japan, spent 10 years in a Zen temple, a Zen monastery in Japan, and became a serious, serious practitioner of Zen Buddhism. Came back to the States and bought a piece of property with Allen Ginsberg in the Sierra foothills, and has lived there ever since. And Snyder is one of the great practicing environmentalists in this country, amazingly influential poet and essayist. And so it's like I've been in my mind juxtaposing Ken Kesey and Gary Snyder in certain ways. And it's around this issue of power. This is a book called Gary Snyder, Dimensions of a Life. It's a collection of essays that was written really in celebration of Snyder's 60th birthday, which was now over 20 years ago, 1990. One of the essays is written by Robert Aitken, who is, Aitken was the first American to be officially a Zen Roshi, a Zen priest in this country. And Aitken and Snyder have known each other for a long time. Aitken is thinking about Snyder and about the kind of impact that Gary Snyder has had on a lot of people around the world. And Aitken puts it in the context of power. He says, there's an acknowledgement of power, but it's not the power of control, but the power of a life of wisdom and compassion that by its very presence is persuasive. It is the leadership recognized in traditional societies, not dependent on manipulation and connections, but resting firmly on human nobility that is evident to all. And And he associates this with the Chinese word tei, T-E. If any of you are familiar with the Tao Te Ching, that's the second word in the Tao Te Ching. And so the Tao Te Ching can be translated as the book, Ching, of the way of power. Way, Tao means way. When missionaries first went to China and were translating the Bible into Chinese and got to the Gospel of John, the question was, how do you translate logos? In the beginning was the word, in the beginning was the logos. Right? And the word was with God, and the word was God. And what they did was, they translated as, in the beginning was the Tao. And the Tao was with God, and the Tao was God. And so that notion of Tao as an underlying reality. Right? But the tag, you know, power, we have our own associations of power, but in this context, power is this power of alignment with this way. Power comes with this connection to that underlying way of all things. And we would say, of course, alignment with God. So this power is called Tei in Chinese, the way and its power. It is a particular appeal because it comes from a unique human being. Buddhist metaphysics identify this, skip that part. Let's see. The sage, the wise person, is one who cultivates his or her own nobility using the teaching that has been handed down as guidance, but evolving and maturing from the private compound of affinities that was seated at conception. Each of us has our own te, our own power, our own connection to this underlying truth. Translate this in Christian terms, you could say, we are members of the body of Christ. Our power, in a sense, comes from our deepest connection to that underlying way. My own sense is that one of the things I love about being at Holden is that I feel like I get reconnected, recharged, plugged back in some ways, to really fundamental things. Being in the wilderness does that to me. Being in the mountains, being close to those kind of sources, very much related to my experience of Christ. So that's the sort of thing that Aitken is talking about. Each of us has this quality. And there's this inner nobility. Nobility is like a navigational beam that keeps one on course through zigs and zags, acknowledging that nobody is perfect, least of all the one who practices perfection. And then he goes on and talks about Snyder. But nobility is like a navigational beam that keeps one on course. And I do experience that here. You know, we're just seeing the bus off, and friends of ours are just leaving on the bus. A woman who has a daughter who is 14 and is just heading off to high school. Right? And it's like, I didn't say this because I didn't really have much of a relationship with the daughter. But watching her go off and thinking about her heading off to high school in Seattle, it's like part of me wanted to say to her, it's like, you got in touch with something. She had 2 weeks here at home. My guess is you got in touch with something fundamental, some fundamental truth about yourself, your own nobility. I think this is one of the things that happens here. We get in touch with something true, something real about ourselves. And then we go back, and it's like I want to say, don't lose touch with that as you're entering high school and all the things that are pulling at you as a 14-year-old girl walking into a large public high school. All the things that are pulling at you. Right? And somehow it's like, hold on to that. And there is this power, I think, that we have, that we experience in those circumstances. So there's that on the one hand. We were talking yesterday also. I was reading from Parting of Waters, 1962. So we've got John Wayne shooting Hatari in Africa, and complaining because the ice cream hasn't showed up. Right? We've got the world where millions of people are going to see Hatari, are going to see The Music Man, going to see James Bond and Dr. No. This is a reality that much of America is sharing. Music at the time, let's see, what were the popular songs? Tony Bennett. Anybody guess? I Left My Heart in San Francisco.
Of course.
Gene Chandler, Duke of Earl. Ray Charles, I Can't Stop Loving You. The Four Seasons, Big Girls Don't Cry, and Sherry. Little Eva, The Locomotion. For some of you, most of you probably, all this will be absolutely new to us. How many of you remember Bobby Boris Pickett and the Monster Mash?
Monster Mash.
All right. Neil Sedaka, Breaking Up Is Hard to Do. That's the reality. I mean, that's what we were listening. I was 9 years old, right? And I'm just beginning to be aware of the radio at that time. And my first records were Four Seasons records. And I was a big Four Seasons fan. 1962. So there's that reality. Simultaneously, you've got Martin Luther King, Ralph Abernathy, right? The Southern Christian Leadership Conference, down south in Georgia at this point, all right, trying to integrate the town of Albany, Georgia. And what happens is that King and Abernathy are arrested in Albany, Georgia. So this is Taylor Branch. King and Abernathy went to jail on the historic day when live television pictures first leaked across the ocean via Telstar Communications. All three television networks broke into their evening programs with a picture that appeared simultaneously on French and American screens. Vice President Lyndon Johnson was shown huddling with excited scientists, all watching themselves on television, in the act of watching themselves. In the infinite regression of the media age. For the return transmission, French authorities selected a simple headshot of actor Yves Montand singing the little song. The content of the beams was trivial in comparison with the feed itself, which the Times hailed as rivaling in significance the first telegraph transmission by Samuel Morse.
It happens all the time.
Yeah, more than a century ago. Okay.
Do you know where it is?
I have just the reply to continue here.
Yeah, I can't
remember.
There's a warning.
So, King and Abernathy are put in jail, and it's a huge embarrassment to the Kennedy administration, to the powers that be in Georgia. By this time, 1962, Martin Luther King is an internationally known figure. Right? And so when King is thrown in jail, it's newspaper headlines all around the country. It was second only under the Telstar Communication on the front page of the New York Times. Martin Luther King in jail in Albany, Georgia. And so it's hugely embarrassing. The question is, how do we get him out of jail? Right. Because King refuses to pay the fine, of course, and instead is staying in jail because that's what's galvanizing attention. President Kennedy took a phone call from James Gray, his old college acquaintance, who is now chairman of the Georgia Democratic Party. This is the same James Gray who had written a front-page editorial in the Albany Herald in which he denounced Albany Negroes' complaints about segregation as, quote, the Hitlerian tactic of the big lie. The Negroes are lying. The Department of Justice knows they are lying. This sordid effort will fail, as all of the craft and cunning the Negro agitators have employed in their plottings for months have failed. It will fail because its motivation is essentially evil. James Gray, head of the local Democratic Party. So, and James Gray had known Kennedy in college, so what does he do? He calls Kennedy in the White House, his old college acquaintance. Gray said he was calling with Mayor Kelly standing there in his office, quote, and the nice thing is, of course, all these things were recorded. And so what Taylor Branch did, once there was access available to these, he went and listened to all these thousands and thousands of recordings for this book. So he's got the quotes. Jack, we've got Martin Luther King in jail, he said, stating the obvious. The damn media is having a field day. We don't want him in jail, but what can we do? He violated our law, that is, you know, breaking segregation laws. Right. I'll tell you, it would be very nice if you sent somebody down here to pick him up. It's like calling the President of the United States, Jack, please take care of this for us. The president agreed that it was very bad to have King in jail, but he did not embrace the idea of having him released for some presidential purpose. They faced an impasse that was politically delicate. King refused to compromise with segregation. Albany refused to compromise with immigration. And the administration was determined to maintain an image of masterful control without intervening forcefully on either side. These constraints called for trust and stealthy maneuver. President Kennedy promised to send someone to Albany, and he advised Gray to consult immediately with the Attorney General, who was Bobby Kennedy. By midday, a hastily recruited Gray emissary was on a flight to Washington. In the meantime, the Chief of Police, Pritchett, is trying to negotiate with the African-American leaders who are gathering, as always, in the churches. And again, gathering more and more energy with King in jail, right? Because all this attention is now on Albany. And outside, there were a group of rock throwers who were not actually part of the nonviolence movement, but just folks whose rage at the situation had grown to a pitch. So, let's see, cutting to the chase here. Once the rock throwers had melted away, Senator King returned to the Shiloh pulpit to lay bare a conflicted appraisal. The chief had come in, had, you know, tried to argue for calm and, you know, thank you to all the African-Americans, you know, and he's wearing these two faces, basically. One trying to be gracious, on the other hand, he's got 30 or 40 people locked up in his jail still. On the one hand, he praised the congregation for welcoming Chief Pritchett in the charitable spirit of nonviolence and for proving that the movement people inside were not like hoodlums outside. The chief had been warmly welcomed with applause rather than being thrown out or violently attacked. On the other hand, he lamented the signs of sycophantic admiration for Pritchett. These were deep roots of segregation, he said. After all, the very purpose of their meeting had been to exhort people to challenge Pritchett's authority by offering up their bodies to his jail. We want to give him respect. Respect, said Slater King, but not like he's some kind of god. Maybe I'm guilty of this myself. It's the system we've been conditioned by, like we've been brainwashed. And that's my transition. Okay. So if we go back into the novel, what that preacher was recognizing, I think, was that the system, I'll just put it as a question. What does he mean? What does he mean that we've been brainwashed? What is he suggesting?
What is Kesey's suggestion?
No. What is this? The preacher who is speaking to his congregation and these other African Americans who had and he makes a really interesting point, I think. On the one hand, he is congratulating this group of people filling this church who had warmly welcomed the chief of police into their midst, rather than violently rejecting him, throwing stones, or whatever. So on the one hand, he's saying, thank you for, in a nonviolent way, welcoming the chief into our church. On the other hand, he says, perhaps we welcomed him too warmly. That there was this, you know, what was his expression? His sycophantic admiration for the chief of police. The implication being that there is too much given to his authority, that we are applauding too strongly for him, when in fact we are in opposition to him. And we are willing to put our bodies on the line in opposition to all that he represents, as the chief law enforcement officer in Albany, Georgia. And he puts it in terms of, we want to give him respect, but not like he's some kind of god.
Right.
Maybe I'm guilty of this myself. It's the system we've been conditioned by.
Hmm.
We've been brainwashed. So it's that that I want to tease out a little bit. And I'm seeing people nod. So what is he getting at?
Trying to find a compromise. They don't want to, they're trying to avoid a violent conflict.
Yes.
But
yes.
On the other hand, they
yeah.
they want to get king out, so they're trying to, and by doing that, they're having to let this guy in, and
yes.
let's work together, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
it is a
narrow line, for sure.
Yeah.
You could have somebody come in and be stony silent.
Yes, that's also true.
And not, you know, you're welcome, but we're not applauding,
yes.
you
mm-hmm.
know, it's a,
yeah.
you're used to a servant-master relationship. And that's what it is.
Right.
It's you've been brainwashed and you've been doing that for your history in the country,
yeah.
and that's what you're trying to break that cycle.
Yes.
So by doing
yes.
that,
yes.
it's the cycle
yes.
you're embracing
yes.
the police coming in, but you're also embracing, in a way, the cycle if you're going to greet him in that manner.
Yes. And he is the representative of the
mm-hmm.
it's white male authority.
Right.
Power.
That's a power.
Huh.
Yeah.
I think that. They had been used to going along to get along.
Right.
And this
well,
is a
mm-hmm.
break.
Absolutely.
Of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's so tempting. And here it was a conciliatory move in some ways by the chief to come in here without a lot of other armed men with him. Although he was armed. But he walks into that crowd. So there's an appropriate recognition of that. But I think what pastor is recognizing is that there was something else going on.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm reminded of, and I don't want to digress too much on this, but I think this is a pretty succinct example of what the brainwashing was. Brown versus Board of Education, 1954. The Supreme Court decision about segregation in public school system. Thurgood Marshall, who later was Supreme Court Justice, first black Supreme Court Justice, was the one who was arguing that case before the Supreme Court. One of the things he did was he brought a psychiatrist from Chicago who had worked with young black girls in the Deep South. And one of the things that psychiatrist did was a very simple thing. He had those girls playing with dolls, and he had a black doll and a white doll, and just, you know, which doll do you want to play with? And these black girls, young girls from the Deep South, over and over again chose the white doll to play with. And of course, you know, why are you choosing the white dolls? And they would simply say, unconsciously, those are better. Those are better. Now, where are they getting that idea? That is, it's so deeply ingrained in the culture, in the system, that white is superior to black. And that was one of the primary arguments that Thurgood Marshall made in the Supreme Court. Right? That what the South was arguing is that really we can do segregation. We can do equal but separate in our school systems. And of course, if you know anything about the school system in the South, it was entirely, you know, bogus. Right? But that was the argument. And really what Marshall was saying is, you know, it's so deeply endemic, this sense. And that's, I think, what that pastor is talking about. How do you change that sense? How do you instill a sense of that inner self-worth, that notion of nobility, that you are worth something inherently? Right? And the church was a primary avenue for actually doing that. Okay. Now, we translate that to the beginning of this model, and you've got Chief Broom, who is for decades has been in this mental hospital, and we're talking about those walls, the sense of confinement within those walls, and then identifying himself as deaf and dumb, which creates another wall, another barrier, a sense of safety around himself. And this is a guy who is, I forget, we're told he's like 6'4 or 6'8, I mean, a very large, powerful male figure potentially, but sees himself as very small, as incredibly vulnerable and deeply wounded because of the situation in which he's grown up. It's a large part of it. And in contrast, and so at the very beginning of the novel, you have this hierarchy of power. You've got the black male attendants who are under the big nurse, and they take out their power on Chief Bromden, who is in some ways one of the lowest of the low. And so you have in front of you the first couple of pages, and I just want to return to this. There's a good example here in the early pages. If you can turn to page 5, and there are a few more copies I think up here. Big Nurse has just entered the beginning of the day. It's early morning. There's a paragraph on page 5 beginning. Then she cites those black boys. They're still down there together, mumbling to one another. Anybody see where I am?
Yeah.
And if somebody can just start reading about a page or so. Read a few paragraphs in. Somebody would just pick up.
They're still down there together, mumbling to one another. They didn't hear her come on the ward. They said she's glaring down at them now, but it's too late. They should have known better to group up and mumble together when she was due on the ward. Their faces bob apart, confused. She goes into a crouch and advances on where they're trapped in a huddle at the end of the corridor. She knows what they've been saying, and I can see she's furious, clean out of control. She's like to tear the black bastards limb from limb, she's so furious. She's swelling up, swells till her back's splitting out the white uniform, and she's let her arm section out long enough to wrap around the three of them 5-6 times. She looks around her with a swivel of her huge head. Nobody up to see just old Broom Bromden, the half-breed Indian back there hiding behind his mop and can't talk to call for help. So she really lets herself go, and her painted smile twists, stretches to an open snarl, and she blows up bigger and bigger, big as a tractor, so big I can smell the machinery inside, the way you smell a motor pulling too big a load. I hold my breath and figure, my God, this time they're going to do it. This time they let the hate build up too high and overloaded, and they're going to tear one another to pieces before they realize what they're doing. But just as she starts crooking those sectioned arms around the black boys and they go on to ripping at her underside with the mop handles, all the patients start coming out of the dorms to check on what's the hullabaloo, and she has to change back before she's caught in the shape of her hideous real self. By the time the patients get their eyes rubbed to where they can halfway see what the racket's about, all they see is the head nurse smiling and calm and cold as usual, telling the black boys they'd best not stand in a group gossiping when it is Monday morning and there is such a lot to get done on the first morning of the week. Mean old Monday morning, you know, boys. Yeah, Miss Ratchet. And we have quite a number of appointments this morning, so perhaps if you're standing here in a group talking isn't too urgent. Yeah, Miss Ratchet. She stops and nods, and some of the patients come to stand around and stare out of eyes all red and puffy with sleep. She nods once to each. Precise, automatic gesture. Her face is smooth, calculated, and precision made, like an expensive baby doll, skin like flesh colored enamel, blend of white and cream and baby blue eyes, small nose, pink little nostrils, everything working together except the color on her lips and fingernails and the size of her bosom. A mistake was made somehow in manufacturing, putting those big womanly breasts on what would have otherwise been a perfect work. And you can see how bitter she is about it.
And that's going to be, I wanted to read that paragraph, because that's going to be one of the threads that runs through this novel. And we'll come back to that briefly. But so, what are the connections between what we've just been talking about in terms of what's going on in Albany, Georgia, and where we are in this novel? Anybody make a connection? Yeah.
It seems like there's a moment of decision with the part where it says, oh, maybe they're going to come to their senses and do something, or they'll rip each other apart.
Yes.
It seems like the veil of authority is so thin, or it could be that she's physically like bursting out of her kind of her look, and on one hand it's looking at your authority for what they really are, but also recognizing how easy it would be to ignore it, I guess, and like 3 versus 1 alone is enough numbers to surpass that, but somehow this thing they like describe her as this almost like a baby doll and this like beautiful woman right afterwards, and so it's like it goes back and forth between like almost like this mini revolution, and then you're back at like kind of idolizing this, you know, again, or fearing idolizing.
And of course that word revolution, I think that's the first time in these 2 days that word has come up. But when we're thinking about this transition period, and that we were talking a lot about yesterday, 1962, we're on the cusp of something. And one of the key words, of course, of what we're on the cusp of is revolution. I mean, that was what, if we associate the 1960s, if you want to find key words, revolution would be one, liberation, freedom, et cetera, et cetera. And there is very much that sense. And revolution suggests that there's something underlying, there's some kind of energy that is waiting to be released. And this novel begins from that place. And there's also the implication is that there's something that is trying to keep that energy from coming forth.
Because they know, it's like they're all afraid of what if they let it go.
Yes.
They need to let it go, but
yeah.
The unknown.
They're not ready. Yeah.
Yeah. And where is this power, where is this energy going to lead? And the potential, I mean, there's two possibilities. One is, of course, violence, a violent revolution. Right. And this is the tension. I mean, again, the Taylor Brack book is so powerful because it really takes us inside of the struggle that King and others were having to create a non-violent movement, harnessing tremendous energy that had been built up over centuries in people. Mm-hmm. And that one natural outlet for that energy was just violence. There is so much rage that's one form of energy. And if you can channel that, this is the one thing, this is what Gandhi understood, this is what King understood. If you can channel that in a nonviolent way, it can be a tremendous power. And this novel, I think, is playing with some of these same ideas. Right at the very beginning, the first words we get in the opening paragraph, repeated over and over again, is the word hate, one of the key words. These black boys, right? Hating their work, hating the situation that they find themselves in, and taking it out on Chief Bond.
And so it's just with the status quo.
Yes.
It's like they've been living this way, and they've got their routines in life, and this is how, and if they rock the boat and change everything, then it's like, well, now what do you do? You know,
yes.
I like my routine, and I,
yeah.
But I want change, so
yeah.
They want it both ways.
Yeah.
Something's
so,
got to give.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're acting out. I mean, what we see in the situation is that they've been off talking amongst themselves. And we're not privy to their conversation. Right? But there's something about the way they're standing there that also sets off Nurse Ratched. They sense she's glaring down at them, but now it's too late. They mumble together, their faces confused. She goes into a crouch. She knows what they've been saying. I can see she's furious, clean out of control.
So it's power. You're taking the power.
Yeah.
Threatening her power.
Yes.
She's got to stop.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And so, in a way, it's like them huddling together is a microcosm of whatever that energy is. And it's not like they're plotting revolution necessarily. But there's something going on that she senses, that she picks up on. And so her response is quite large. Now, this passage, what Chief Rondon sees, literal or figurative, in terms of what he actually seems to be seeing about what's happening with Nurse Ratched here. Is he describing something that's literally occurring? Probably not. Probably not.
Transformers.
You can't hear what they're saying.
But he can't hear, so.
Well.
Yeah.
They think he's deaf.
They, exactly, exactly.
So that's another whole element to it.
Yes, yes. And so we were saying yesterday, he's able to listen in, and he can't hear literally what they're saying, but he is picking up on something, I think that's the thing. And so on the one hand, his description, we might say, is the description of somebody who is neurotic and who is seeing something that's not real. Example. Right? First of all, she's out of control. She's swelling up. Swells till her black back's splitting out of the white uniform. She's left her arm section out long enough to wrap around the 300 5-6 times. Okay. Now, obviously,
it's not literal.
It's not literal. It's not literal. But
how much of this is, you know, he's a Native American, he's an Indian, and he's seeing what this white person is going to be doing to the blacks,
yes,
and thinking about the Native American experience through the years.
Yeah, and it's not explicit,
right.
But what he's seeing, and I guess maybe the way of getting at this is that clearly what he's seeing is not literally happening, but is he seeing something true and real in another sense?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Because he identifies with
yeah.
their situation, because
yeah.
it's
yeah.
his situation too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in an odd way, that there is a connection between what those the black attendants are experiencing and what he experiences.
Right.
And he is able to tune in to what is really going on. On the surface, it's just, oh, she's angry and she's going to bawl them out. And what he sees as something,
there's oppression.
Oppression and something that's just about to come apart at the seams. Right? That's the metaphor. Right? She's swelling up till her black back, I keep wanting to say black, her back's splitting out of the white uniform. She blows up bigger and bigger, big as a tractor. So big I can smell the machinery inside, the way you smell a motor pulling to the load.
And they mentioned black machinery in the first.
Yeah.
Black machinery.
Yeah. And so he associates her with machinery. And ultimately his word for really what's going on in the hospital, and the hospital is a microcosm of what's going on in the country as a whole. He uses the image of a combine, right? There's a lot of machinery that is operating. And that has in some ways taken over the country. And it really is, in his mind, a kind of conspiracy. And that we're all part of the combine. We're all part of the machinery. And we've all been wired. And the thing about Rondon is, what makes him neurotic or what we might clinically call psychotic is that he takes that literally. Right? That he thinks that there are actually wires implanted all over and inside of us. And that we've all been wired, and we've all become part of this big machine. Right? Yeah.
But a machine per se is not necessarily a bad, monstrous, oppressive thing. And a well-oiled machine is kind of a compliment for something that's working really well.
Yes.
But this is a machine that's kind of burning. It's, you know, it's like when you try to drive and you have the e-brake on or
yes.
something like that. So burning rubber, you can smell it and things like that. So a machine that's got something wrong with it.
And it's true. I mean, there's a passage later on where Murphy is associated. He's brushing his teeth, and the description is something like, it's like the pistons are going. And so there's a machine that's working appropriately in a certain way. By and large, this novel will oppose imagery of machinery versus natural imagery. Right? And of course, the chief and the Indian is associated with that natural imagery. It's the river, it's the Columbia River, and so on and so forth. Right? And the machinery tends to get associated with technology, with control, with manipulation, and so on, to a great extent. And again, the novel has a kind of black and white dynamic to it. A lot of critics have said, I mean, Kesey grew up reading comic books. And there's a certain comic book quality to some of this in terms of the black and white dimension. And we get that even in this image of her swelling up. You can easily imagine this as a scene in a comic book. But he's also seeing something true, that there is this rage that's in Nurse Ratched, that's in these black guys, that's in all the men on the ward. What do you do with this? Okay. If you go to the next page, Nurse Ratched says, why don't you take Chief Bronwyn before breakfast and give him a shave? This seems a relatively harmless thing, page 6. But for Bronwyn, this shave is part of the work of the Talmud. And so you get, let's see, about the middle of page 6, if somebody could pick up. Before anybody can turn to look for me, I duck back in the mop closet. See where we are? So just read a couple of paragraphs in.
Before anybody can turn to look for me, I duck back in the mop closet, jerk the door shut dark after me, hold my breath. Shaving before you get breakfast is the worst time. When you got something under your belt, you're stronger and more wide awake, and the bastards who work for the combine aren't so apt to slip one of their machines in on you in place of an electric shaver. But when you shave before breakfast, like she has me do some mornings, 6:30 in the morning in a room, all white walls and white basins and long tube lights in the ceiling, making sure there aren't any shadows, and faces all around you trapped, screaming behind the mirrors. Then what chance you got against one of their machines? I hide in the mop closet and listen, my heart beating in the dark, and I try to keep from getting scared, try to get my thoughts off someplace else, try to think back and remember things about the village and the big Columbia River. Think about a one time Papa and me were hunting birds in a stand of cedar trees near the dolls. But like always, when I try to place my thoughts in the past and hide there, the fear close at hand seeps in through the memory. I can feel that least black boy out there coming up the hall, smelling out for my fear. He opens out his nostrils like black funnels, his outsized head bobbing this way and that as he sniffs, and he sucks in fear from all over the ward. He's smelling me now. I can hear him snort. He don't know where I'm hid, but he's smelling, and he's hunting around. I try to keep still.
Okay, skip to the final paragraph at the bottom of page 7, and read that if you would.
What does it start with?
A blue tick hound, in parentheses, okay. Blue tick hound bays out there.
A blue tick hound bays out there in the fog, running scared and lost because he can't see. No tracks on the ground but the ones he's making, and he sniffs in every direction with his cold red rubber nose and picks up no scent but his own fear. Fear burning down into him like steam. It's gonna burn you just that way, finally telling about all this, about the hospital and her and the guys, and about McMurphy. I've been silent so long now it's gonna roar out of me like floodwaters, and you think the guy telling this is ranting and raving, my God. You think this is too horrible to have really happened. This is too awful to be the truth. But please, it's still hard for me to have a clear mind thinking on it. But it's the truth, even if it didn't happen.
That's a famous line.
No, it's the truth.
It's the truth, even if it didn't happen. What is that?
That's fiction.
Yeah, it's fiction.
But it is our reality, too.
Yes.
That's what you said.
And of course, this is Kesey as a fiction writer who is claiming something about fiction, about the power of fiction, that's something that's made up and yet is able to get at a deeper truth. And, you know, a perfect example of that is that scene we were just talking about where Chief Bronwyn is seeing the nurse getting larger and larger and larger, right? In a scene that. That would be like a science fiction movie, a horror movie. And the best horror movies are metaphors, actually, for our psychological and spiritual reality. That's what they're depicting. Right? They're showing us through metaphors what is actually going on. And that's, so what Bronwyn was seeing was, in fact, the truth, even though it wasn't the literal truth. I mean, there's something so large, so powerful, that is erupting. And that's what he's feeling. So, yes, it's the truth, even if it didn't happen. And in these passages, he's also just describing his own fear. And it's that fear that has made him feel smaller and smaller and made him, in a way, want to be as invisible as possible. That's that sense of being deaf and dumb. And that, too, I think Kesey catches something true. There's this, again, the deaf and dumbness is a kind of metaphor as well. That we don't want to hear, and we don't want to speak out. We don't want to speak truth, and we don't want to hear truth. It's that contrast between what America, to a great extent, was experiencing in 1962. What was, what were the films, what were we going out and seeing, as opposed to what was going on in the jail cell in Albany, Georgia. And of course, we can translate that into our present reality as well. What is it that I'm not looking at? What is it that I'm not allowing myself to really fully experience? Whether it's in my own life or, in the world around me. What am I missing? What am I deaf and dumb to? And he uses this image of the fog as an image that comes up throughout the novel. That the combine creates this fog, or there's a fog that fills the space. And for Bromden, in his psychosis anyway, that's quite literal for him. I mean, he experiences that the floor fills with fog. In the fog, you can't see anything. It's as if you can't find your way very easily. And again, as a metaphor, it's a pretty powerful metaphor. I know for myself what fear feels like. And it is like the mind is in a kind of fog. That parenthesis of this hound being out there in the fog, running scared and lost because he can't see. That's the image. And that's what Bromden has been living in until McMurphy arrived. And the other passage that I gave you, you can finish, is just beginning to dip into that. And if you don't have a copy of it, it's there. McMurphy arrives, and he is a kind of Western hero in some way. This is page 81. And what we learn is that he has actually been in prison and has been transferred from a work farm to the mental hospital. And he partly sought that out because his thinking was, well, this is a good deal. He's got, 45 days or something like that, but it's really hard work in the work prison. And being in the mental hospital instead, you're not working. So it seems like a pretty good deal. But what he doesn't know is that having been committed to the mental hospital, he is not in control of when he gets out. That's the piece that he is unaware of. It's the nurse who's in control. It's actually technically the doctor, but the doctor is primarily under the power of the nurse. So that's the missing piece that he's unaware of. At any rate, he comes in and basically takes over control of the floor. He's a gambler, he's a ladies' man, and calls himself the Bull Gooseberry. And in this passage, we get a good slice of Randall P. McMurphy. His initials are RPM. And so, that's again, this novel is about power, it's about energy, it's about what makes things move and work. And so McMurphy carries his own energy in a certain way. He has this sort of internal power. So we got a few minutes left. Anybody pick up with Come Morning, McMurphy is up before I am?
What page was that?
That's page 81.
Oh, right, okay. Come morning, McMurphy is up before I am. The first time anybody been up before me since Uncle Jules, the wall walker, was here. Jewel was a shrewd, old, white-haired Negro with a theory the world was being tripped over on its side during the night by the black boys. He used to slip out in the early mornings, aiming to catch them tipping it. Like Jules, I'm up early in the mornings to watch what machinery they're sneaking onto the ward or installing in the shaving room. And usually it's just me and the black boys in the hall for 15 minutes before the next patient is out of bed. But this morning, I hear McMurphy out there in the latrine as I come out of the covers. Hear him singing so you'd think he didn't have a worry in the world. His voice is clear and strong, slapping up against the cement and steel. Your horses are hungry, that's what she did say. He's enjoying the way the sound rings in the latrine. Come sit down beside me and feed them some hay. He gets a breath and his voice jumps a key, gaining pitch and power till it's joggling the wiring and all the walls. My horses ain't hungry, they won't eat your hay, aye. He holds the note.
Nicely done.
He holds the note and plays with it, then swoops down with the rest of the verses to finish it off. So fare thee well, darling, I'm gone on my way. Singing. Everybody's thunderstruck. They haven't heard such a thing in years, not in this ward. Most of the acutes in the dorm are up on their elbows, blinking and listening. They look at one another and raise their eyebrows. How come the black boys haven't hushed them up out there? They never let anybody raise that much racket before, did they? How come they treat this new guy different? He's a man made out of skin and bone that's due to get weak and pale and die, just like the rest of us. He lives under the same laws, gonna eat, bumps up against the same troubles. These things make him just as vulnerable to the combine as anybody else, don't they? But the new guy is different, and the acutes can see it. Different from anybody been coming on this ward for the past 10 years. Different from anybody they ever met outside. He's just as vulnerable, maybe, but the combine didn't get him. My wagons are loaded, he sings. My whip's in my hand. How'd he manage to slip the collar? Maybe like old Pete, the combine missed getting to him soon enough with controls. Maybe he growed up so wild all over the country, batting around from one place to another, never around one town longer than a few months, when he was a kid, so school never got so much a hold on him. Logging, gambling, running carnival wheels, traveling, light-footed and fast, keeping on the move so much that the combine never had a chance to get anything installed. Maybe that's it. He never gave the combine a chance. Just like he never gave the black boy a chance to get to him with the thermometer yesterday morning, because a moving target is hard to hit.
One more paragraph.
No wife wanting new linoleum. No relatives pulling at him with watery old eyes. No one to care about, which is what makes him free enough to be a good con man. And maybe the reason black boys don't rush into that latrine and put a stop to his singing is because they know he's out of control, and they remember that time with old Pete and what a man out of control can do. And they can see that McMurphy's a lot bigger than old Pete. If it comes down to getting the best of him, it's going to take all three of them and the big nurse waiting on the sidelines with a needle. The acutes nod at one another. That's the reason they figured that the black boys haven't stopped his singing, or they would stop any of the rest of us.
Okay. So there's a lot in these two pages, but briefly, there is clearly McMurphy is again a kind of power source, out of control of the combine. He's associated with a kind of wildness, a kind of freedom. His singing is an image for that. And that's something, I mean, there's something very beautiful in that description. The freedom that this guy has as he's singing in the latrine and singing this sort of cowboy western song. His voice is clear and strong, slapping up against the cement and steel. That's Kesey's writing at its best, I think. I mean, there's power just in the writing. And now this is the lip prof in me. that the word slapping, strong, clear and strong slapping up against cement and steel, all those S sounds, the alliteration of that, there's just this energy and power and freedom that comes in those lines that I think beautifully catches something of McMurphy's power here. Right? And so there's something really beautiful about what he is bringing and the sense that the whole place can feel there's something new and free and open. And it is a Western quality that McMurphy represents. It's the mountains, it's the wild rivers, all of that. And so the whole place is thunderstruck.
Yeah, right? One word I keep coming up with is hope.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
Change.
That he's bringing this, you know, wicked metaphors. He's bringing fresh air, he's bringing life, he's bringing energy. And there is, and we'll see, there's a strong sexual element to that. Right? There's a virility that he brings. Right? And that's, we're going to have to talk about that tomorrow and the next day. But there's also, there's this other quality that, so what is it? No wife wanting new linoleum, no relatives pulling at him, no one to care about.
Freedom,
but no responsibility, no connections, yeah. No relationships. Right? So that's also part of what McMurphy, and to an extent, the West has represented. Right? And so I'm just inviting us to recognize these two sides. And I want to come back to this because he brings a kind of power and a kind of energy and a kind of freshness, but I juxtapose it to what Robert Aitken, and I'm circling back to where we began, the way Robert Aitken talked about the power, the nobility of an acknowledgement of power, not the power of control, but the power of a life of wisdom and compassion that by its very presence is persuasive. A life of wisdom and compassion that brings a sense of power. And I go back to Martin Luther King, who clearly conveyed a sense of power. But what is it that gives him a sense of power and authority? What is that quality? It's something else. It's very different than what McMurphy is bringing. So I just wanted to kind of hold those things in tension. And I'm guessing that our time is up.